A while ago, I made two entries in my journal, which I would like to share with you. I'm afraid the first is a bit raw. It begins, "What are my feelings about being a woman? I hate it. Get screwed financially, socially, vis-a-vis authority, by government, by church, by academia. Bear most responsibility for the family, an undue burden without respect or recompense. Taken for granted, expected to submit, to cater and to bend to men. My power is expected to be given over, always for the glory of men. Owned, used, screwed." The second is simply my dream, being in touch with my source, having access to insight, inner experience, and power, connectedness with creation and people, flowing, being, bringing forth, evoking, loving, nurturing, confident, free, secure, responsible, willingly interdependent, harmonious, vibrant, exuberant, using my rational and analytical powers to bring forth the things I choose. I think such fury and such hopes are fairly typical of Christian women today. In this time of cultural transition, it seems to me that we are faced with a double challenge: to understand ourselves as feminine persons and to open ourselves more and more fully to the love and power within us. To begin, therefore, is to ask just what femininity is or has to do with. In actuality, it took me a number of years to ask that question, because I was angered by the fact that distinctions between men and women had so often been used as a means of oppression and limitation, as well as their having so often degenerated into caricature. So I chose to ascribe any apparent differences between men and women to cultural conditioning. Experience has shown me, however, that to develop a firm sense of identity, I have to reflect upon and to acknowledge my femininity per se. Today I tend, therefore, to accept traditional characterizations of the masculine and the feminine, so long as such characterizations are understood to be descriptive rather than normative, and to carry no connotations of inferiority or superiority. The following list, greatly abbreviated, should provide a basis for our discussion. And then I just simply have the feminine and the masculine opposed. The feminine being intuitive, the masculine rational, evocative, directive, being, doing, establishing connections, analyzing differences, internally oriented, externally oriented, right brain, left brain. As mature adults, we all need to encompass all of these faculties so they are available to enable us to respond to a variety of experiences with maximum effectiveness. On the other hand, because I am a woman, my expression of what we might momentarily label a masculine faculty will be indelibly affected by my feminine nature. My singing is qualitatively different, not superior or inferior, but different from my husband's singing. So is my preaching, my counseling, my parenting. The exploration of my feminine being has brought me face to face with a legion of demons, fears, fury, and ongoing temptations. Such demons seem to populate the stories of contemporary women. I encounter them in private conversations and published statements time and time again. The fears include the fear of not being adequate, the fear of not really being feminine, the fear of not being good enough, the fear of not being lovable, the fear of not being strong enough, the fear of not being respected or respectable, the fear of not behaving appropriately, the fear of not having the right to put my needs above those of others, especially children or one's partner. Every single one of these fears stems from a failure to love and value the self, to have resolved the issues of self-love, self-esteem, and self-worth. Fury, such as I shared earlier, is usually triggered by cultural and individual stresses. Anger has its own energy. It is possible to use that energy constructively, to acknowledge one's anger, to probe for its causes, and through understanding, deal responsibly with the self, and therefore with one's environment. But it is very tempting to use that energy destructively, to respond blindly, unleashing an explosive blast which injures all in its path, including one's own self. There are other temptations. Especially prominent is the decision to settle for less than the best for ourselves and in ourselves, to reject our God-given heritage to become whole human beings stretching to the full stature of Christ in favor of our cultural bias for sacrifice and martyrdom. Women seem to find it particularly difficult to behave as responsible adults who ask for what they want. Each time we shy away from that responsibility, we stunt our growth spiritually, physically, socially, and personally. Competition can be another trap, whether it be directed predominantly towards men or women, the results are identical. Competitiveness blocks our ability to relate to another person and to communicate clearly. As a result, competition is a barrier to the giving and receiving of love, which is the essential project of any relationship. In wrestling with and learning from these issues, I have found it important to sort out what things seemed idiosyncratic, what developmental, that is appropriate to a particular stage in my personal family or family life or career, and what the result of sociological factors. The value in making such distinctions lies in their enabling me to take responsibility for my life and move from despair through anger and fear to understanding, choice, and action. As I grow more able to take responsibility for my life, I am increasingly able to remove those blocks to my experience of the love and joy which continually are welling up within us from our source, God. Love comes to us as inspiration, insight, and awareness, as well as efficiency and strength, and is often accompanied by a general sense of well-being, what I would call grace. It enables us to live more effectively and to experience satisfaction, which leads in an ever-expanding spiral to further energy, accomplishment, joy, and well-being. My dream, my vision of how life as a woman can be, is an image that I live out of and live towards. It is at once a sign of and a means to enhance self-love and self-esteem. As such, it is a continual source of strength. It stretches my narrow concepts so that my percepts are not continually limited. It opens my eyes to the rich possibilities in my experiences rather than encouraging me to peer into the gloom of my expectations. Sharing other women's experiences provides further encouragement. I gain inspiration, I learn, I know myself as part of a common cause, both indirectly through the media and directly through personal relationships. I discover the support which comes in the move from isolation to community. Love and learning are synergistic. Relationships with men also formed a vital part of my experience. They contribute to my knowing myself as a woman by stimulating me to interpret and articulate my experience more precisely, even as they provide the opportunity to appreciate and learn from others their own male experience. In our dialogues, I find I am quickly pressed to drop all pretense to victimhood, to be responsible. Besides which, they're fun, and I treasure the vitality and joy which flows through them. Speaking comparatively, late 20th century America is a good time and place to be alive as a woman. Awareness of our shared political and financial concerns, especially with regard to equal pay, equal work opportunities, and equal access to credit, seems to be on the rise, and with it the machinery to secure these rights. It is certainly obvious that social mores have been shifting. We seem to have growing options as to whether or not we will marry and at what age, as well as whether or not we will bear children and who will be responsible for rearing them. Progress takes time, but it does seem to be coming. Progress also seems to be coming in the growing appreciation for right brain functions throughout Western culture. This is evident in the use of imagery and biofeedback techniques in medicine, in the focus upon altered states of consciousness in education, scientific research, and business, and in the seminal influence of holism. Among Christians, we find widespread interest in prayer, meditation, and healing, a growing concern for the experiential in theology, and a renewed interest in ritual. For the first time in several centuries, women, long in the majority in church membership and activity, are moving into positions of leadership among laypeople and clergy. According to scholar Joan Chamberlain Engelsman, the most significant cultural shift in our era may be the re-emergence of our awareness of the feminine dimensions of the divine. Since we are mid-course, she does not presume to predict the final outcome, but suggests three possibilities: a heightened appreciation for the feminine aspect of each member of the Trinity, a focused awareness of the Holy Spirit as a feminine being, or the inclusion of Mary into the Godhead as the fourth member of a quaternity. Despite such tantalizing prospects, living out one's womanhood in the context of the Christian tradition is an ambivalent experience. Jesus himself, of course, was radical in his relations with and attitudes towards women. Not only did he number women amongst his closest followers and friends, most notably Mary, Mary Magdalene, and Martha and Mary of Bethany, but he traveled with them, taught them, and even relaxed with them. For an itinerant rabbi of first century Palestine, such behavior was scandalous. Furthermore, Jesus includes many explicitly feminine subjects in his stories and parables, and his metaphors for the divine include several distinctly feminine images, such as picturing God as a divine hen gathering her chicks under her wings. After the crucifixion, however, Jesus' followers did not live up to such radical ways. The figure of Mary, the mother of Jesus, is an excellent example of how our tradition presents a double face to women. On the one hand, Catholic Christians have held an explicitly feminine figure as central to their myth. Seen at her best, Mary is compassionate, nurturing, and intuitive, a classic model for contemplative spirituality. And she was understood to maintain an active presence in the ministry of both Jesus and the earliest Christians. On the other hand, her real physical nature as a human female is denied. She is presented as a non-physical being. Named ever virgin, she is said to have never consummated her marriage nor borne other children after Jesus, despite scriptural evidence to the contrary. In fact, later tradition describes her as being born without the stain of original sin and dying without a trace of bodily corruption. As a feminine ideal, she is a forbidding model, impossible to emulate. Taking a rather different slant, medieval legends portray Mary as illogical, vain, manipulative, and sometimes petty in her coquettish mercy. She emerges as a capricious adolescent. When a 14th century Franciscan writer describes how to avoid punishment for one's sins, she compares the Queen of Heaven to the heroine in a courtly love tale. Just as when we wish to avoid a king's anger, we, and this is a quotation, go secretly to the queen and promise her a present, then to the earls and barons and do the same, then to the free men of the household, and lastly to the footmen, so when we have offended Christ, we should go first to the Queen of Heaven and offer her, instead of a present, prayers, fastings, vigils, and alms. Then she, like a mother, will come between thee and Christ, the Father who wishes to beat us. Here she is powerful but immature, just as for the church fathers, she was admirable but not truly feminine. Mary is always imprisoned by her patriarchal pedestals. Christianity has been and remains an essentially patriarchal institution, despite its occasional deviations from the norm. For example, the leadership of women in many of the Pauline house churches, the rule of women abbesses over the double monasteries, that is, male and female, within the medieval period, and the role of women preachers and evangelists in early Quakerism. Nevertheless, at its core, the tradition is radical, calling men and women alike to wholeness and freedom, to become the sons and daughters of God, friends, not servants of Jesus. These are images of adulthood, of responsibility and choice and maturity. These images, this central core of the tradition, keeps me Christian. Here I find my affirmation, and here let's see, if I was being affirmed right there. Here I find my affirmation, and here I claim my lineage as a frame through which I can know and celebrate the fullness of God as manifested in creativity, responsibility, and rebirth, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. As a matter of simple integrity, I have to acknowledge the ways in which institutional Christianity has distorted its reflection of God's fullness and joy. But after my anger and anguish has come an appreciation for one aspect of this reality, that out of the depths of my own idolatry, I would create gods of any book of Scripture, any church, or any theology which seemed an adequate expression of the divine. In my frustration with the inadequacy of my tradition, I am challenged to make the leap from religion to God. For that, I am grateful. In making that leap, I turned within, choosing to experience the depths of myself, to go into and beyond the personal memory and conscious awareness, through dreams and a host of other altered states of consciousness, to reach what Eliot called the still point of the turning world, that point where our sense of self is both left behind and found, where the paradox of our being entirely alone in the world, creatrix of all reality, and our being utterly connected beyond the boundaries of individuality to all and everything, where that paradox is momentarily in balance, in the perfect tension of resolution. It is here I find my basis for living. Daily meditation is a first priority. If it didn't work, I wouldn't bother. Spiritual exercises have only one function in my life: to be recreative. If they are stimulating and educational, they tend to come lightly, As sacrifice or good works, they are worse than useless to me. They are destructive. The instant I engage in devout practices, I become more and more self-righteous, less and less responsible, further and further off course. All that saves me is the simple fact that I tend to fall flat on my face promptly. To experience myself as a free, responsible, loving woman is a constant exercise in wholeness. Such a self-concept comes only from acknowledging every aspect of my being, my intelligence, my hopes, my dreams, fears, angers, and ugly habits, my courage and integrity, my lies and manipulative behaviors, my masculine and feminine energies, my physical and psychic capabilities and limitations, all of me. And to take it all in, to try to understand it and to be responsible for it and to grow, is also my way of growing in my awareness of the divine. How else can God reveal God's self to us except through the very medium God created, ourselves? That seems to be the point of the incarnation. Out of the experience of wholeness comes a natural overflow of joy and appreciation and love to others, and hence the gift of relationship. Relationships are useful mirrors. As I watch how I respond to those with whom I have put myself in relationship, I can see where the blocks are, the fears, the distrust, the resentments and manipulations, so that I can remove them as fully as possible. In the process, the floodgates of love open a bit wider to allow the great surge of celebration and joy to continue. Another implication of all this is that as a Christian woman, my doing is necessarily rooted in my being. When I am in touch with my source, I am open to inspiration and creativity in a heightened way, more capable of handling my life responsibly, and hence more able to live with that energy and enthusiasm which I take as a sign of grace. Depression or dis-ease is thus a clear signal to me that I'm off target, sinning in fact as well as in entomology. We live from creativity to action. It is our visions or images which create our reality, and not vice versa. For example, if I choose to live out of a state of freedom and therefore act freely, it creates the reality of my being actually free. Theologian Letty Russell labels this process living proleptically, living as if the change one wants to effect has already occurred in order to effect the change. When I reverse the process and try to control the details of my life in order to support the inductive generalization that I am free, I find myself so nervous over every hint of failure or limitation that I end up in self-pity. And since self-pity is a denial of my ability to make choices, it is an absolute barrier to freedom. To work, my doing needs to proceed from being. To facilitate a primary encounter with the divine being and focus our doing, Catholic Christians use ritualized corporate worship based on symbols which trace back beyond Christianity and Judaism to prehistory, as well as meditation, which it would label contemplative prayer, and intentional relationships. They are tools which have worked for me. As a woman and a priest, I try to articulate my experiences of the Christian tradition in such a way that it is accessible and relevant to others, to enable them to assess it for themselves and make use of whatever seems helpful. Months ago, when I began this paper, I conceived of its title as The Struggle to be a Christian woman in the 1980s. Since then, I have been more able to acknowledge the sheer goodness of life, the pleasure that comes with facing into my fears and dealing with them, and learning and growing within my relationships. Life is only a struggle when I choose to make it one. Although there are very real cultural pressures upon women today, we can choose to be challenged and stimulated by them rather than dismayed or crushed by those pressures. To live out the 1980s in celebration rather than in struggle and stress may well be the greatest contribution any woman can make to her culture or to herself.
Anne's paper was called Being a Christian Woman in the 1980s, and as you would guess, this is called Being a Christian Man in the 1980s. I found when I set out to write this, it was a very different kind of task to write theology from the point of view of a woman or theology from the point of view of a black, is to articulate all the differences from the prevailing worldview that one discovers in a journey into oneself. And I first discovered all the similarities, which to me spoke more than the paper itself. To speak of the task of a Christian man in the 1980s is to distinguish the task of a man from that of a woman. Now, I am more comfortable speaking as a man rather than as a person, in quotes, because we speak with greater authenticity, I think, out of our lived experience as men and women than when we are speaking out of the abstract personhood we are getting used to now as a concept. I do not, of course, presume to speak for all Christian men. I happen to be a white, middle-class, Episcopal priest who was raised as a Jew in Chicago and became an Episcopalian as an adult. The particularity of this experience determines the parameters of my theology. To theologize always is to reflect on our own experience and its relationship to ultimate values within the context of our own tradition. The tradition of the Episcopal Church, like that of the Church of England, which is its parent, includes a deep respect for the scriptures, which does not, however, extend to literalism, a profound reverence for our history, which does not, however, extend to adoration of a fixed tradition, and a very great regard for the ability of the individual, using his or her own reason and conscience, to reflect on the complexities of an ambiguous existence, which does not encourage, however, flights of fancy that are not grounded in both scripture and tradition. I intend to address two dimensions of the task of the Christian man. The first is the task in general, vis-a-vis the world in the 80s, and focuses on three spiritual crises: the crisis of powerlessness, the crisis of fear, and the crisis of rigidity. The second is the task vis-a-vis women. Why is it necessary, you might ask, to address the task vis-a-vis women? For one thing, women are not men, and their experience, and therefore their theologizing, has a different cast. For another, in my church, women do most of the work. They might not do most of the public speaking, but they do most of the work. Then, I am married to a woman who is also a priest in the Episcopal Church, who shares responsibility with me for the oversight of our congregation. Because she matters to me, it is important that I listen to her reflections on her own experience so that I can understand her. Furthermore, the roles and experience of women are a very live issue now, at the heart of the identity crisis of our civilization, and we don't have to like that to know that we had better pay attention to it. Our sons and daughters are growing up in a world that will differ profoundly from our own. Lastly, all men contain within themselves, as do all women, both feminine and masculine dimensions. Inner peace comes only when the man and the woman within each of us have been reconciled. You might notice that the way a man treats women generally is a good clue to his attitude toward the feminine dimension within himself. Now, it is not a function of denomination, class, or any other sociological phenomenon that power versus powerlessness, fear versus love, and flexibility versus rigidity are crucial issues for men endeavoring to be Christians in the 80s. These issues are axiomatic to the existence of all men, I think, whose hearts are good, whose intentions are noble, but who nevertheless live in a speeding, highly technological civilization on an overcrowded planet, the pressures of which cause havoc with our hearts and our good intentions. The circumstances in which we all live pressure us to be rigid and to feel fearful and powerless. All those feelings are at bottom functions of self-love and self-esteem. One's sense of self-worth is at the heart of one's sanity, or lack of it, especially when societal pressures conjure up within ourselves the demons of meaninglessness and the insignificance of our own individual existence. We all need to contribute meaningfully to the lives of those around us. Power is the ability to use oneself and one's resources to do that. Genuine power has nothing to do with winning or dominating. When we do not know how to exercise our own power, often we choose to have negative impact rather than no perceived impact at all. The futile attempts to control and dominate others, futile because the human spirit is infinitely various and resourceful, as well as devious, in the ways it will not be squelched or denied, issue from powerlessness, which is often a function of self-hatred and hatred of others. The only antidote to feelings of powerlessness is self-love and love of others, in short, compassion. Nor is powerlessness experienced without fear. Fear issues from lacking security while one wants to have it. If ever there has been an era which, hurtling into the bow shock of the future, has generated insecurity, it is ours. Ironically, in middle-class America, much of our insecurity comes from having rather than not having. Out of the naive belief that owning things would generate security, even though we all know that all we own does nothing of the sort, we amass and stack up. The more we amass, the more we fear the loss of what we have, and the more we become enslaved to it. The more we are attached to things, in other words, the greater our alienation from ourselves and therefore from God. We really do know, don't we, that after a while we don't have things, things have us. We don't own our homes, our homes... Talk about a mechanistic world intruding on the life of the spirit. We don't own our homes own us. We give our homes our paychecks, our time and energy. We fill them with nice things, and still they won't let us go. Often when we leave them, we think about how they're doing. I hesitate to state the obvious, yet it's so obvious that we all forget that it really is true. The more we need to preserve, protect, and increase what we have, the more insecure and frightened we become. The more we identify ourselves, our real selves, with things or institutions or anything abstract or outside ourselves, the more we fear, because the security we crave remains beyond our reach. Security cannot come from anything or person outside ourselves. It can only issue from the depths of ourselves. It can only come, ultimately, from God. Another way to get at this is to say that what we are, in essence, is love. And when we are in touch with our own deepest reality, we are in touch with love itself, and God is love. When we touch our secret hearts, we touch love, and fear, to our disbelief, to our astonishment, and to our joy, vanishes. When we mistake ourselves for something outside ourselves, when we identify, for example, with a structure, our church, say, then it must follow that we are very threatened when that with which we have mistakenly confused ourselves is threatened. We feel as if, should it disappear, I will disappear. I, however, am not it. I am only myself. When we confuse our deepest selves for the structures or institutions we ourselves have created, we commit idolatry, of course, and there is something in the Bible about God not liking that at all. God will react, in fact, we are told, like a jealous lover and tear its eyes, whatever it is, clean out. This is to say that the living God, which is spirit and truth and power, constantly shatters the illusory creations of our own hands and minds and imaginations in order that we can experience once again only God, who is alive and full of fire and passion and gusto. Passion and gusto, the exhilaration of merely being, are not always easy to experience. We prefer structures, idols, and therefore rigidity. Rigidity, obviously, issues from powerlessness and fear, which generate the inability to move with and within life itself, which is really the inability to experience life itself. Out of our desperation, we build dams and pretend the river isn't rising. And just as security is discovered in detachment from things, so letting go and living among but not within our own structures allows us to be flexible. There is no maturity without flexibility, and there is no love without maturity. The task, then, of the Christian man in the 80s is to be loving, responsible for his own power and its use, and flexible in the midst of a decade which makes it very difficult to be those things. I ought to note that being loving, genuinely powerful, and flexible are states of being in and out of which we move. Our goal is to be in them and act out of them more and more. Well, if that is true of our obligations generally, what are we to do about women? First of all, let's face one fact squarely. We may like it or not like it, celebrate it or feel guilty about it, but generally speaking, men hold dominating positions in the structure of our society and therefore perpetuate the structure which ensures that they do. Men can no more help being oppressors of women than whites can help being oppressors of blacks in middle-class America. It may anger us to know this. The fictions we love most are those we only whisper in secret. But men do, in fact, do most of the things the literature of sexism identifies. Now, I am not urging that men experience a paroxysm of guilt on hearing this. I am not urging the sentiments of a dying liberalism on anyone. I'm simply saying that we will be doing ourselves a favor if we simply notice that sexism is entrenched and that it cannot be changed easily, either in men or in women. Men have, above all else, one single task vis-a-vis women, not to be responsible for them. Now, I did not say not to be caring, loving, or nurturing in all the real ways, but not to be responsible for them. The greatest freedom available to men today is that which comes with not trying to be responsible for another adult human being. For one thing, I can't be responsible for another adult, even if we both pretend that I will be. That's why so much resentment and covert sabotage always shows up in dependency relationships that mitigate the freedom and the spirit of both partners. For another thing, I am only meeting my needs to have power over another rather than to be powerful when I encourage a woman to let me be or do for her. Genuine power always consists of empowering another to be themselves. It is not coercive. Remembering that security cannot come from outside ourselves. When men encourage women to believe that their own self-worth is dependent on what the man can provide, the woman is denied the experience of her own value being generated from within herself. She is encouraged to idolize the man who replaces God as the source of her well-being. So men can give women no greater gift than to care, love, and nurture without being responsible for the other. Now, this is very threatening stuff for us men, who have been encouraged to believe that our self-worth can come from our women. So we are very ingenious and very subtle in the varieties of punishments we hand out to women who try with mixed results, naturally, in our confused world, to be responsible for themselves. When women move toward accepting responsibility for the quality of their own lives, men often fear their loss, especially if they have come to believe that the women are only hanging around because they're taking care of them. I think some of the anger we men experience in the face of women's liberation and its rhetoric comes from the anxiety generated by the deep knowledge that we cannot give women what we pretend we can provide: security, self-esteem, and a sense of well-being. Only God can do that. And women are as connected to, as rooted in, God as we are. And we are not, we have to remember, God. God is God. We are only ourselves. But what can men do realistically in the midst of all this change and confusion and threat? I suggest we can deal realistically with ourselves, especially with our fears. We can look at our projections, the witches, crones, and hags of our imaginations, and see where they really come from. We can wrestle with our fears of women and their power, especially their power over us, which is the only kind that is really threatening. And we can face the fact that dominating and controlling others does not really lead to satisfaction and fulfillment, but only to more fear, because we can never control enough. Death, frailty, sinfulness are all woven into the fabrics of our mortal bodies. So the more we fear, the more we need to control. And we wind up hating ourselves and those we have tried to bind to ourselves with coercion, threats, or force. The journey out of that morass begins with loving oneself. Not loving others, but loving oneself. When we love ourselves genuinely and give ourselves what really provides satisfaction and a sense of well-being, simultaneously we come to love and value in others what we have discovered we can love and value in ourselves. We fear and hate only what we have not learned to love in ourselves. Here's an exercise for you. Think of three attributes of people you just can't stand. Think of three of them, traits which drive you absolutely crazy. And now notice that these traits are you, aspects of yourself. You start loving that in you, and what a surprise it will be to discover that love of others just like you just happens. The enemy within ourselves, which is really the only enemy there really is, can be loved into thin air, whereas the more we fight and assail those parts of ourselves we resist, the stronger they become, the more power over us they have. So it is really a single task, then, for Christian men in the 80s. Love yourself and love others. If we can learn to work at loving as diligently as we pursue another car or a bigger home, we can claim for ourselves the power to act, the ability to contribute, and the opportunity to experience a boundless joy. And then when we are with others out of love and joy, the men and women in our lives will respond with love and joy of their own. Thank you.
I agree with Richard Thieme's introductory remarks about the particularity of one's background impacting on one's theological perspective. In my own case, I come at the question of being a Christian male in the 1980s as a white, middle-class professor of human resource management who was raised as a Mormon with my childhood years spent in rural Idaho. While I will endeavor to keep my remarks more general, that is, about being male and Christian, my Mormon and rural roots are likely to protrude. I like these papers. They are personal, provocative, and in most ways espouse my own beliefs. I would like to build on several of the points presented by the themes. First, a note of caution. The themes are both I agree with Richard Thieme's introductory remarks about the particularity of one's background impacting on one's theological perspective. In my own case, I come at the question of being a Christian male in the 1980s as a white, middle-class professor of human resource management who was raised as a Mormon with my childhood years spent in rural Idaho. While I will endeavor to keep my remarks more general, that is, about being male and Christian, my Mormon and rural roots are likely to protrude. I like these papers. They are personal, provocative, and in most ways espouse my own beliefs. I would like to build on several of the points presented by the themes. First, a note of caution. The themes are both saying, it seems to me, that the central task of being Christian, male or female, is to evolve enough self-love, self-esteem, and self-worth that one engages in a godlike process of loving, empowering others, being flexible and fearless, and learning by sharing. The end result of this development is unselfishness and expansion. But having just witnessed the me decade of the 1970s, we must be wary of the initial process of such development, lest personal and spiritual growth become self-indulgence and selfishness. Christopher Lash's book, The Culture of Narcissism, hits this theme. A recent article by Daniel Yankelovich in Psychology Today points out a self-fulfillment contradiction. That is, we seek our well-being, creativity, leisure, autonomy, pleasure, mental and physical improvement, materialism, adventure, stimulation, vitality, by turning inward. And while the goal is to expand our lives by getting beyond self, our strategies constrict and draw us to an ever-narrowing, closed-off I. By keeping all our options open, we, by working hard at our awareness and personal growth, in effect, diminish our choices. Yankelovich goes on to point out a further problem. He says that although none of this self-indulgence would have been possible without an economic machine which fostered great abundance, freeing people up to be concerned with other things, he quotes, "We have also moved from an uptight culture of the 1950s, set in a dynamic economy, to a dynamic culture set in an uptight economy." The point of caution for us, of course, is found in the Savior's admonition that in large measure we also find ourselves by service and getting lost in our love for others. We all know the limitations of interpreting this admonition as self-denial and deferred gratification, pretending that ourselves and our marriages need no maintenance nor new growth. But there is also an equal danger involved in treating ourselves as what Richard has labeled things or possessions, which will eventually lead us to fear and insecurity. I mention this point in part because my own feeling about the LDS culture is that in many ways the doctrine so frequently espoused of family success and family togetherness and family eternity has become its own idolatry, a form of inner search, even of indulgence. As a member of a city council in a small Utah community, 95% of which is Mormon, I have observed that it is old-timers, the labor class, the poor, and the artistic subculture who seem willing to get involved in community service. The rich, and we have many, and the well-educated are not only too busy supporting their materialisms and their culturalisms, but take refuge and justification in the all-pervasive excuse we have a family activity, or my family comes first. Another issue I would raise as a discussant relates to the first point and builds on both Richard's and Anne's comments about reconciling the masculine and the feminine within each of us to become androgynous in the Jungian sense of the term. I would ask us as Christians to consider in our search for male and female identity, ceasing eventually to veer from one end to the other on this continuum of masculine and feminine. While it may be critical for our development to discover and differentiate ourselves as males and females along the way, the end result of such differentiation may, in fact, stint our growth and impede our relationships with each other and with the Lord. I'll try to explain what I mean by that, because it's sort of a far-out statement. Gordon Thomason said it well in a recent essay in Exponent 2 entitled Latter-day Liberation. And let me just quote him. If we take care to distinguish between worldly and gospel values, it becomes obvious that many Mormons, in the past men especially, but increasingly more women as well, are seeking and claiming a right to opportunities and rewards that can only be derived from a way of life that is in ultimate conflict with the gospel of Jesus Christ. While on some issues the contradiction is obvious, in most other areas debated, we find a common underlying theme, that women be allowed to be as selfish as men. It is ironic that those who most loudly preach Adam Smith's false gospel of selfish individualism as a cure for economic ills cannot recognize that same philosophy at the core of much of the women's movement they so vehemently oppose. I see society at the present time often overcompensating for its opposite side. And since most men have not even yet begun the developmental journey, that is, are light years behind their sisters, it's easier to focus here on what's going on with women. I see many women as overcompensating or becoming, in a more popular way of terming this, male squared. Because this is a natural developmental stage, perhaps this is a natural developmental stage prior to healthy integration, but it seems to me that it has its own danger. If one reads the organization literature these days, for example, one is struck by the number of manuals for women on how to seize and maintain organizational power, targeting the top, paths to power, the new assertive woman, games mother never taught you, to name a few. Power in organizational politics is a central theme of most women's conferences that I have attended. I agree and advocate that women have as much right to power as men, even if organizational power has come to symbolize what is male. And I don't think that's right, but I think it has. But it bothers me as a Christian that the women I see, at least in the business setting, aren't questioning more the ill effects of this kind of power, are slow to raise the same red flags that Richard discussed when he spoke of negative and positive power. In my own research and theory on organizational politics, I point to the cost of the getting ahead strategy, although that certainly needs to be a choice, and also point out some other power options, which I call getting free and getting by. I'm frightened of the awesome cost individuals and families pay when they adopt wholeheartedly this traditional male power model. It also concerns me to read articles such as the one I'd like to quote from in the Wall Street Journal of August 20th, 1981, about 10 days ago. And I quote, "It has taken Charles of the Ritz Group Limited 2.5 years and $750,000 to develop Singcow, a woman's fragrance being introduced this month. The company and its ad agency have sorted through 250 scents, analyzed competitors' products, studied various bottle shapes, and even programmed a computer to name the perfume. Mostly, though, Charles of the Ritz and the agency have talked to women. not about what they want from a fragrance, but about what they want from life. Their answer, adventure, luxury, and sex, especially sex. Now, says Charles of the Ritz, there's yet another sort of female. I passed up the thing that told about the traditional kind in whatever kind of fragrance used to be used. Another sort of female, she's looking for, quote, she's looking for some danger. She wants the passionate, adventurous life. She's a connoisseur of luxury, says Lois Garacci Ernst, president and creative director of Advertising to Women, Inc. Quote, men are part of her life, but she'll have a meaningful relationship with whom she wants, when she wants. The world is her toy. She's the queen of the jungle. Or, as Singh Kalyad say, she's not going to marry the boy next door. Well, that caught me because of its humor, but it does make the point. In the Mormon culture, my sense of overcompensation and over-differentiation from male, female, and exploring those two sides of the continuum, has impeded the healthy interrelating of men and women, something Anne has advocated. I understand from Jill that historically the male and female worlds have been quite separate, not just in the LDS Church, but in American society. In the recent past, the Church has certainly promoted this theme. From boyhood, I was taught to be wary of seductive females, to keep them at arm's length, to not travel in twos but in groups of three or more, to be courteous but formal and distant. Thus, it would feel unnatural in much of Mormondom to interact closely with another female in a truly collegial sense. I find the relationships typically distant or flirtatious. They are father, daughter, mother, son, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or boss, subordinate. Males and females have little experience relating as colleagues. Moreover, much of the organizational structure of the LDS Church forms two separate organizational worlds, a male priesthood structure and a female relief society structure. There is some minimal interdependence on tasks in the MIA and the primary. Nevertheless, the self-awareness movement in the Church, especially as it relates to women, since I'm not sure it started for men yet, has also contributed to this two-world phenomenon. Mormon women groups are active and have now been in existence for some 10 years. And ask me to tell you sometime, along with some other people that are here, about the Mormon men group that we started. LDS women have their own periodicals and societies. They caucus at meetings of Mormon scholars. Because of their own need for identity and their own developmental stage, as well as the less advanced development of their Mormon brothers, I sense at the present time an exclusion by Mormon women of Mormon men, further exacerbating what has been perpetrated by the males lo these many years, but resulting still the same in separate worlds, making it difficult for true collegiality to occur. Referring again to Richard's paper, what does our fear and treatment of each other as males and females tell us about ourselves? From Anne's viewpoint, are we retarding our eternal progression by forming separate male and female subcultures? These papers were truly provocative for me, and I apologize for sounding out off at such length, but the issues of self-indulgence rather than true self-growth and overcompensation for masculine and feminine characteristics do seem important to me in becoming Christian persons in the 1980s. Yeah.
I also responded with great appreciation to these papers for their careful thought and also for their eloquence. I would really like to go to St. James and hear these people preach. I responded with agreement and affirmation of the values they presented, which appealed to me both rationally and spiritually. And I have to admit that I responded also with some awe and a little bit of envy, because it seems to me that the themes represent people who are very spiritually aware, who feel somewhat at peace, and they carry with them the love born of those who know and love themselves and God. Anne's closing lines, challenging women to live out the 1980s in celebration rather than in struggle, left me feeling particularly inadequate, since I am still in the midst of struggle. I think both of these papers acknowledged a lot of personal struggle as they theologized, or as Richard defined it, and I liked his definition of theologizing, reflecting upon our own experience in the context of our own traditions. Many of Richard's ideas were developed within the context of opposites, that is, power versus powerlessness, fear versus love, rigidity versus flexibility, a sense of self versus the structures outside of self. Anne also spoke of fury and hopes, demons and grace, right brain, left brain, being, doing, struggle, celebration. And both of them, of course, talked about male and female and masculine and feminine. And for a few moments, I would like to focus on some of these polarities generally and then specifically address the masculine-feminine. Anne talked about a healthy self-concept coming from acknowledging every aspect of my being, my intelligence, my hopes, my dreams, fears, angers, and ugly habits, my courage and integrity, my lies and manipulative behaviors, my masculine and feminine energies, my physical and psychic capabilities and limitations, all of me. This variety of opposites that Anne finds within herself, I think, is within all of us. It is, in fact, part and parcel of life on earth. An oft-quoted Book of Mormon scripture speaks of an opposition in all things, or else, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness, neither holiness nor misery, neither good nor bad. Wherefore, all things must needs be a compound in one. The papers by the themes have given me cause to think about this more deeply. I've come to recognize that there is in life joy and sorrow, pain and relief. And I have come to see these things as coming and going in life. But I appreciate the opposites that have been presented here, the rigidity, flexibility, community versus self, spirit versus law, sinner versus saint, religion versus God. These are helpful things for me to think about and understand in what ways they occur in life, or, as Richard said, they are states of being in and out of which we move. I think there are a lot of paradoxes presented here, and it makes me understand in part why I struggle. And I think Anne's reference to T.S. Eliot and the still point of the turning world is what she said, the perfect tension of resolution. And I'm not sure how long it exists in any of our lives, if in any of these paradoxes it is more than momentary. I was interested that Anne quoted T.S. Eliot because I've been delving in to him myself lately, and was intrigued by something he had to say which deals with paradoxes for me. In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, in order to arrive at what you... Oh, excuse me. Let me start again. In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go through the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know, and what you own is what you do not own, and where you are is where you are not. And I suppose that for me, this means that developmentally, I have had to go through some rigidity to arrive at flexibility, be deeply involved in the community to understand myself, adhere to the law that I might understand the spirit, and acknowledge myself a sinner in order to truly become a saint. Not that I have, by any means. But I guess the question I find myself asking is, how many times does this go on? Is it a continual round of acknowledging ourselves sinners that we might more be saints, understanding the law better that we might more fully understand the Spirit? And again, I appreciated Richard's statement that the best of these are states of being that we move in and out of. And what about the masculine and feminine? Is this also part of the equilibrium? Are we going to be working our whole lives to balance out the masculine and feminine parts of ourselves? I think for Brooke and myself, we're certainly in the middle of that balancing, that after years of being a sweet Mormon girl, I think I moved into a real achievement mode and probably explored a lot of the masculine sides of myself in a very fulfilling and happy way. And I think since our marriage, I have moved more into nurturing and exploring that side of myself and really enjoyed it. I also think for Brooke, he's spent a lot of years of nurturing and enjoying some of his feminine side. And it's just been this summer that he has said to himself, I really know a lot about my feminine side. What have I lost of my masculine side? It is a difficult equilibrium. And as I say, I don't know how much of our lives we spend trying to work that out. But I'm grateful we live in a culture where the options are available for us to explore that fully. And I appreciated the themes talking about this aspect of their own lives. And I suppose in some ways I'd be interested in hearing from Anne about being part of the ministry within her church and what this has shown her about the masculine side of herself and the feminine side of herself. As a historian, I suppose I have, this has introduced some interesting issues for me in terms of the church institutionally, because I suppose that not only do individuals have a masculine and feminine side, but since individuals are what make up institutions, that probably institutions also take on a masculine and feminine flavor. It's interesting to me that in the 19th century, when many churches in America were becoming feminized, Anne Douglas has written a book about the feminization of American religion, I think that the Mormon church has moved into a very masculine mode. It is directive. It does focus on doing. It's very externally oriented and spends a lot of time differentiating itself from the rest of the world. And I suppose one of the questions I have is it possible for the institution to explore its feminine side, to be more intuitive, evocative, to concentrate on being and establishing connections and encouraging its members to be internally oriented? And how can that feminization come about? And my sense is that it is not through women only, but it is through all individuals who recognize those aspects of their own character and bring that to the institution, that perhaps some hope of change is possible, certainly if not within the institution as a whole, at least within a more spiritually aware membership. Ecclesiastes tells us that to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. And I suppose the question I would raise is it time to break down within Mormonism, some of the doing, some of the external orientation, and a time to build up some of the being, some of the internal orientation, a time to keep that which is good in our tradition and to cast away that which is not. And I suppose that that's only part of our individual growth and our community growth, and hopefully there will be times when individually and collectively we can celebrate that perfect tension of resolution, even if only for a moment.